From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Rachel Dewoskin returns to the show this week. She's the author of Foreign Babes in Beijing, which is a memoir of her experiences as the star of a soap opera in China. And her first novel was Repeat After Me, and you should already have read that, people. I told you about that one a while ago. Her new book is Big Girl Small, and you'll love it. And as soon as the show is over, you should go get it. Rachel Dewoskin joins us from Beijing. Rachel Dewoskin, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
How are things in China this morning?
They're very interesting. I'm up high above the city. I can see the CCTV tower from my window, which is spectacular.
There was an article about it.
And chaotic.
There was an article about it in the New York Times today.
I saw it. I have to say I agree. I think it's actually the most amazing building I've ever seen.
Now, you ran off to China specifically to avoid meeting me in person when we were both in New York a couple of weeks ago.
That was my number one priority. But I also had other things sort of lighting fires underneath me of various sorts.
You spend your time equally between China and the U.S. now, or what?
I don't. I'm in the U.S. for the academic year because my little girls are in school, and I'm teaching at University of Chicago these days. And we spend the summers in Beijing. So essentially, we winter in Chicago and summer in Beijing. It was not a strategic decision, but it worked out that way.
Well, what are the summers like there, weather-wise?
It's like an oven. It's a wall of heat. You walk outside, and the air is a solid matter. But it's really an exciting place to be. And I need to do some time every year here. And since we have academic jobs, it works out brilliantly.
So you have a furnace in the summer and an ice chest in the winter.
Exactly. It reminds us that transitions are possible.
It's the worst of both worlds.
Right. Weather-wise, that's true. But emotionally and intellectually, it's a totally thrilling contradiction.
So what do you do in China?
Well, this summer I've been in Shanghai quite a bit. I have a literary residency courtesy of M on the Bund, this glamorous restaurant, and a brilliant woman who runs it named Michelle Garneau, they've put me up in this little bird's nest of an apartment on Suzhou Creek. I'm working on a screenplay about concubines. It's just a project of love. And then in Beijing, I'm working on an article for Vanity Fair about Chinese Twitter.
Oh, are there a lot of Chinese Twittering pictures of their crotches a la New York?
Yes, well, there's an Anthony Weiner. There's a Chinese Anthony Weiner who famously tweeted a plans for a clandestine rendezvous with his mistress publicly. And there is actually also an official who tweeted a naked picture of himself.
And is the public outrage as great as it was over Weiner?
I would say it's essentially the same. It's public glee, mainly here. I don't know about outrage. The standards for officials are a little bit different here. Although they both lost their jobs, if that's what you're asking.
Well, did the fellow deny it the way Weiner? I think Weiner probably would have been okay if he'd have just said, don't ask me about it, it's my own private business, and leave me alone. But he came up with sort of that, well, it could have been me, I can't say that it wasn't me, that kind of thing. How did the Chinese guy respond when confronted with this thing?
I think it was undeniable. Twitter is the Chinese Weibo is a little bit different from Twitter. It's more like Facebook. You can't really deny that what you've posted is what you've posted, and they have an identification verification process. So these guys were both verified users, and it was a clear, long exchanges that made it explicitly clear that they were who they said they were. I believe the naked pictures also included his face.
Well, you know, Photoshop, they can do anything. That's how those pictures of me got out there, I'm sure.
I'm sure, too.
Yeah.
Everyone's forgiven you, though, right?
Pretty much. So when you walk on the streets in China, are you still recognized as the foreign babe from your TV show?
Sometimes. It's not with the same lathered frenzy that it used to be. I mean, the show is, you know, a decade old now, so people are like, oh, that's that girl who used to blah, blah, blah. It used to be very exciting, and now I would say people have a very mellow feeling about it, even when they do recognize me.
Is the show around on DVD or whatever the China equivalent is?
No, it's actually very hard to find, weirdly. You can get it. I got a bootleg copy in Chinatown in New York City years ago. And you can get it from various DVD vendors around Beijing, although it's unsubtitled. My own copy comes from taping it off of Beijing TV in the 1990s. I actually had a whole VHS set of the show. But it's a collector's item these days. So if anyone listening has one, let me know.
Okay. Well, we'll start looking for it.
Thank you.
Yeah, and of course, I think you told me that even though you spoke Chinese very well, they dubbed your voice anyway.
They dubbed my voice anyway. This, I think, was a technical decision for them. I think it was less expensive not to do simultaneous sound. And they dubbed me. This woman who did my voiceover work actually was a foreign woman who had been living in Beijing for many years and spoke beautiful Chinese, but they inspired her to have a cute foreign accent, so she did it about an octave higher than my real voice. And way chirpier. I was apoplectic the first time I watched the show.
That's not me.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I couldn't believe my voice. There were a number of things I had trouble believing, and one of them was my voice and my Chinese. My Chinese teacher lost faith. She was like, your Chinese is much better than that.
Well,
they wanted to make a point.
Repeat After Me was such a great novel. I loved it, and I just hope everybody has read it, because it's such a great story. And now you have a new novel, and I love that one, too. And it's called Big Girl Small. And I don't want to give away anything, so I'm going to let you say, this is what this book's about.
Well, it's funny. Big Girl Small is about a little person, a teenage dwarf, who gets involved in a sex scandal in her performing arts high school in the Midwest. And I've now been on book tour for 2 months with the book. And a lot of the questions are about why it seems to be a departure from my other books. And for me, it's, of course, not a departure from my other books. All of my books are concerned with a similar question, which for me is a question about sameness and difference, a question about how we see things and participate in them when we're slightly external to them, peripheral. There's a Chinese expression, pang guanzhe. This is the peripheral observer who stands on the side of, say, a game of chess and plays it better than the players do because she has outside perspective. And I'm always interested in those people in society and in families and how people talk to each other across enormous gaps, whether they're cultural or linguistic or geographical or generational, as in Repeat After Me, or physical, as in Big Girl Small. So here's a kid with this giant physical difference, but whose aspirations and internal teenage life are identical to those of any teenage girl in America. And I had the idea for the book because my baby, who was 4 and a half at the time, loved Wizard of Oz. And we must have watched Wizard of Oz, 6,945 times. And somewhere around 6,000, I thought, the little people in this movie have an outrageous assignment, right? Here you have these utterly professionally trained and dignified actors and singers and dancers who are made to wear pajamas and lick lollipops, and who, it turns out, this was a great revelation to me, although I'm probably not the first person ever to have noticed it, don't have names in the final credits. They don't get billing. It just says the Munchkins played by the singer midgets.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was totally stunned by that. I couldn't believe it. And I Googled it thinking, I'm sure we've come a long way since then. But it turns out we haven't. And if you do a Google search for little people or for dwarf or, any of the terms that people use for little people, it's staggering how kind of insensitive and crazy the language is around this community of people. Meanwhile, Daylan, my 4-and-a-half-year-old, was dressed as Dorothy. So she was clicking around the house in these little plastic red high heels and a gingham suit with like a little proto doll in a basket. And I was thinking kind of gratefully and guiltily how easy it was for her to imagine herself as the ingenue. Here's a kid who watches Wizard of Oz and gets to be Dorothy. And I couldn't help but think, what if she were a dwarf? What if she were exactly the same tiny, belligerent person in every way except actually tiny? How would it feel for her to watch a movie like Wizard of Oz and want to be Judy Garland but involuntarily identify with the Munchkins? And so Big Girl Small is that book. It's about a girl who's small and who wants to be big and famous and happy and beloved like everybody, and how she navigates her adolescence.
So seen as a departure from your previous work because it doesn't involve China or Chinese things?
Yeah, exactly. Especially in China, my Chinese book tour, people want to know, when are you going to write a book about China or culture shock again? And I feel like Big Girl Small is about culture shock.
Mm-hmm.
For me, these books are all, of course, they all come from my imagination, so there's not, the distinguishing lines for me aren't as clear as they might be for somebody who doesn't, say, live inside my mind.
Right, right.
But they're all sort of concerned with similar questions.
Well, so the I don't know, is she a dwarf? You call her a dwarf in the book. Is she a dwarf? Is that what the or we don't say midget?
Yeah, dwarf is the medical term.
Yeah.
She has dwarfism, which makes her a dwarf, and that's a completely acceptable term. And little people is also an acceptable term. And that's, I would say that's about it. You want to go with dwarf or little person.
So, do you mean dwarf as a metaphor then for the outsider sort of?
Well, it's funny. I didn't intend it to be a metaphor. You know, the character came to me before the story did. I had an idea about what if my daughter were a dwarf and watched Wizard of Oz, how would she feel about that? And that's how I wrote that opening monologue. You know, the book opens with Judy in a motel talking about how Wizard of Oz is an American classic everyone loves more than anything, even though there's a whole munchkin land of embarrassed people. And then, you know, from there, I decided what I wanted to write was a story about teenage girls and resilience. Because I think teenage girls are often quite brave and kind to each other, and in fact are kind of warriors. And I don't think they often get credit for those qualities, either in mainstream media or in pop culture or even really in literature. So I wanted to make a teenage heroine who had something potentially debilitating happen to her and then rose above it.
Well, I want to just ask you one little point here. I'm a middle school teacher, so I spend a lot of time with actual teenagers. And at one point in your book, Judy talks about how unrealistic teenagers are in fiction and in movies because they're always way more sophisticated than actual teenagers actually are. And this is true because most of the teenagers that I work with are, with, you know, there's some exceptions, but mostly pretty unsophisticated. On the other hand, your character is really sophisticated and hysterically funny.
Thank you. Well, she's an exception. I mean, my main memory of being a teenager is that I hated being patronized.
Yeah.
And I think teenagers, whether they're hugely sophisticated in terms of their vocabularies or not, have very, very sharp pander radars. And they can tell when adults are condescending to them. And so one of the decisions I made in writing Judy was not to pander. I mean, Judy is a teenager, right? She's narcissistic. She doesn't always do the right thing. She doesn't treat her friends kindly all the time. She tries. But she sometimes, like all of us, teenagers included, gets it wrong. And, you know, the book is, of course, also in large part about the cruel things that we do in moments of poor judgment. And whether when we're teenagers, or any time really, those things can be held against us for life. To what extent do we want to pigeonhole our teenagers? And if teenagers act badly in moments of cruelty or moments of poor, often communal judgment, do we want to have a zero tolerance policy around those mistakes as a society? So it's also a book about teenagers and justice.
Well, I guess.
And I made Judy sophisticated because I wanted her to be able to tell the story, and because I thought her sophistication also creates a terrible sense of yearning. Because the other thing I remember vividly about being a teenager is knowing that there were a million things I couldn't know, and feeling very frustrated by that.
And she does reference those things, which is, you know, was really interesting and realistic. And, well, by the way, we're talking with Rachel Dewoskin, and she's the author of a wonderful new novel. It's called Big Girl Small. So what about you? I mean, is there some Judy? Is there some you in Judy, I should say? And were you like an outsider in school?
It's really funny. I mean, there's me in all of my characters. I mean, I think of each of them as kind of part of my brain.
Your goth Sarah as course, well, mother and all those other things.
Everybody, the mom, the dad, the brothers, even the boys,
uh-huh.
who I, you know, are also my creations and who I think are, you know, 3D and human to whatever extent it's possible to be those things if you're a fictional character. I mean, I didn't have a life like Judy had. I'm not a little person, and I wasn't really an outsider in the way that she was, except in my life in China. You know, I spent large parts of my childhood traveling through rural China. And those trips and that experience of being a little kid displaced in the world, or anyway disoriented, gave me a real sense of what it felt like to be external to what was happening. And it also gave me a real sense that my life, which was taking place in Ann Arbor, Michigan at the time, wasn't necessarily the center of the world, which I think is a very deep lesson for a little kid. I mean, the first time I came to China, I was probably 9. And I remember vividly we went and we saw the giant Buddha in Lashan, which is, you know, 240 feet tall or something, carved into the side of a cliff. And it was absolutely the biggest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. And then at the top, at the parking lot, there were these guys called micro carvers carving Chinese characters in single strands of human hair. And I remember as a little kid, I mean, put kind of simply, China contained for me the possibilities for what was biggest and smallest in the world. Mm-hmm. And it put my house and my life and my identity into that context. So I immediately began to imagine America and Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I was from, as a kind of monopoly board with little houses, my house being like a little greenhouse. And I no longer felt like I could only see things as from the inside. I could only be inside my own cultural context or my own life and imagine the world that way. So in that sense, I was always an outsider. And I always felt a little bit weird. You know, there were the obvious signifiers. My parents are, you know, very adventurous, crazy intellectuals, and we lived in a very kind of laced-up Republican neighborhood. So even when I was student council president, they wouldn't let me support the drive to save the Statue of Liberty, for example. My parents were pro-choice in a largely anti-choice community, that kind of thing. I mean, I had the small signifiers, but I also had this large sense of China as being in the world and as being the center of the world in some way that made me kind of orbiting rather than also central.
Well, also, I guess... big girl, small, is a little bit about reinvention. That is, when we're little kids, you know, we, depending on the group of people we're with, I mean, sometimes some people are with the same students, the same friends from kindergarten all the way through, but sometimes we change schools or we go to this school or that school and there's a larger group coming in, you know, in junior high and high school. And so we have this reinvention, this opportunity to reinvent ourselves. And,
right.
That's one of the themes, I guess, in Big Girl, Small.
Right. Again, this is one of the things that, for me, ties the book to my other books. All of my books are about figuring out who you want to be and how you collect that power and keep it for yourself. And usually, I think you do it, if you're me, you do it by writing. So Big Girl Small is largely also about narrative. It's about how you create a story that you can live with. If something really bad happens to you, you have to figure out how you're going to talk about it, not only externally, but also just to yourself. How you're going to make it into a narrative that you can live with. And then it turns out, I think you can live with it. People can rebound from all sorts of horrible tragedies. And I think one way in which human beings do it is by figuring out a story that they can live with. I think it's part of the project of being human. And the other part of that human project is figuring out who you want to be. And that's, of course, largely contextual. Who do you want to be with? In whose reflection do you like your own image? Who are the people you like, and do you like them because you like them, or do you like them because you like the way you are when you're around them, or some combination of that? And I love teenagers. I've spent my life around teenagers as well. My mom is a high school English teacher, and our house was always full of teenagers, before I was a teenager, when I was a teenager, after I was a teenager, and my teenage friends always flocked to our house. My mom fed us endlessly and gave us tremendous dignity and freedom. So we hung out there, and teenagers have an openness that it's hard not to love. I mean, I think they have an open-mindedness, a kind of willingness to hear about the world and to connect the dots for the first time in a way that makes them very attractive, and an openness to emotional experience. That's why there's a whole section in Big Girl Small about how your brain gets mummified later. When you're a grown-up, your brain is like it's not open anymore in the same way it is when you're a teenager, and I think that's true.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, too. Rachel Dewoskin, in your book, Big Girl Small, which is what we're saying about little people, did you do some research into the lives of real little people so that you could give some authenticity?
I did. I did a huge amount of research. I read dozens and dozens of books. I read novels. I read medical textbooks. I read sociological studies. I watched endless reality television, which I never do. You know, I watched Little People, Big World. I watched all sorts of things. I watched movies. And I wrote to Little People. You know, I wrote to the Little People's Association of America, and I said, please invite me to your conferences. Help me get this right and read my manuscript. And, of course, that's a community, I think, wary of people inviting themselves in for all the obvious reasons. But I was able, luckily, to meet a bunch of very, very generous little people who told me their life stories, told me their high school anecdotes, showed me their yearbooks, you know, that sort of thing, and who ultimately invited me to a convention in Massachusetts where I went and met other families and talked to their kids and hung out. And then I passed the book out widely when it was in manuscript form, and I said, I want it to be right, and I want it to be authentic, but I also really didn't want it to be hurtful. And when I write about China, I feel I've spent so much of my life between China and the U.S. I feel like I can be confident that I'll avoid at least the most egregious stereotypes about Chinese people. Although, even having said that, I did also pass out my China books to Chinese readers and scholars of China and people who know more about China than I do, and I asked for feedback. But I didn't have any such confidence writing about little people. You know, that's not a community that I'm part of. It's not a community I've spent much time in or with or around, and I wanted to make sure that I wasn't hurting anybody's feelings or getting it wrong or being exploitative. You know, this book toes a very thin line, I think, and I wanted to get that line right.
Are you going to come back and write more about Judy? It'd be Bigger Girl, Smaller... No, I guess probably not.
Bigger Girl, Small. That's a good title.
I want to ask you about a couple of other things before we finish. Last time I talked to you, there was some talk about an HBO series about Foreign Babes in Beijing, I believe. What happened?
It's underway.
Yeah.
My husband's a screenwriter and a playwright, and he and I are co-writing the pilot episode with a third writer who's in Los Angeles. And we, you know, we are working on a second draft of that pilot. So, you know, I'd say it's a thrilling project. One of the things, this is counterintuitive, but writing for television reminds me a little bit of writing poetry. You know, I studied poetry in grad school.
Yeah.
And there's something about the skinniness of the genre of TV, of just getting the dialogue, just getting the way people look at each other, the action and the words. I mean, of course, underneath it, there's what people meant to say and what they've accidentally said and all of the kind of subterranean questions and comments. But it's a very streamlined and essential form. It's got a great economy, which is also true of poetry. So that's been really fun. I think when done well, TV writing has a tremendous amount of power in its brevity.
Well, you know, speaking of that, since Judy tells the story of Big Girl Small, I mean, it's kind of the entire book is either in dialogue or monologue, I guess you would say. And I was wondering, you know, since you have a playwright husband, I mean, does he help you with your dialogue? Do you help him with his dialogue? Who's got the dialogue ear? Because your dialogue is so great.
That's really interesting. I would say we do not help each other with dialogue. We do help each other with our manuscripts. So, and in fact, it was in our wedding vows. We vowed to read each other's endless manuscripts, and we've been pretty good about keeping up with that. We help each other a lot, but Zay tends to help me with structure. He's a very good structural thinker, and he helps me organize material. And I like to help him write his women characters. I like to make his women slightly more badass than they sometimes turn out in original drafts. The dialogue, we have very different ways of writing dialogue. He has a play coming up in New York. Maybe you'll have a chance to see it. It's called Outside People in the winter. It's off Broadway at the Vineyard.
Tell us your husband's...
It's a great example of his dialogue.
Tell us your husband's name.
His name is Zay Dorn.
Yeah, it's weird. How do you spell that?
Dohrn.
His parents were radical
activists. It's a Black Panther name.
Oh.
Zayd.
Okay.
I mean, he's like a scrappy Jewish kid from New York, but he's got a radical name. Anyway, his dialogue is much more offensive than mine, let me put it that way.
I guess in some ways people would think, oh, you know, maybe this is a young adult book, but you've got language in here that would preclude it from being included in a young adult reader library.
And more. I think the book is too dark to be a YA book, and we had interest from YA publishers in it, but I didn't have enough time to make a long, deep decision about it. I had the FSG offer was a preemptive offer, so I had to decide in 24 hours, and that didn't give me enough time to consider YA. I didn't really exactly understand that distinction. I now know more about it, having thought about it for a year. But I think this book is an adult book, which I hope will be read by teenagers.
Well, you could maybe do a rewrite, and possibly. But I guess not, because the key elements in the story are too adult for...
Yeah, I would have had to take the teeth out a little bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, I made this very conscious choice not to sugarcoat the thing that happens to Judy.
Yeah.
Precisely because I hated being patronized when I was a kid, and because I think legitimately bad things happen to kids. And I think it's different if you have it be something that's only bad, sort of, or only kind of bad because you're a teenager or because you think it's bad, then it's a completely different kind of story. You know, my new book, I've actually written the draft of a new novel, which grapples with some of the questions that I felt like I became interested in Big Girl Small, but wasn't exactly able to explore adequately in that book. And those are the questions of the boys. So my new book is called Statutory, and it's about a boy who gets in trouble for something he didn't do. You know, I spent a lot of time thinking about the ending of Big Girl Small, thinking about the discipline and punish part of it.
Yeah.
And I talked to a bunch of lawyers, human rights lawyers, children's rights lawyers, juvenile justice faculty in Chicago. I talked to principals of high schools, both public and private. And it turns out, of course, these questions of punishment are largely about class. So if you're an upper middle class white kid, you tend not to get a criminal record.
Yeah, but if you're a lower class person of color, then
if you're a kid of color or you don't have money, then you're in real trouble. Then the police tend to get involved. But so in a case like what happens to Judy, where issues of consent and force are murky and difficult, and the kids have parents who are, you know, who are wealthy, the law doesn't get involved. The schools try really hard to keep it internal, and they can if they're wealthy private schools. And in a way, even if you're the parents of the girl, you want them to, because you don't want your kid on trial, even if what happened to her. Because as we all know in America, girls get investigated just as hard as boys in these cases that involve sex. And they tend not to come out well, no matter what the details are of what happened on the nights in question. And so my next book is about kids who are not middle class. They don't have money. And when they get in trouble, it's a different set of questions.
Well, you know, although there's these dark issues and scary things that happen in the book, it's a really funny book, and I think everybody will enjoy it, and they should go get it right away. And it's called Big Girl Small.
And, thank you.
And the author is Rachel Dewoskin.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me from Beijing and for organizing this phone call.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time, and you'll come back and join us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank Rachel Dewoskin for being my guest this week. Her new novel is called Big Girl Small. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.